welcome to the Circes. Glad you guys are with us for the first time. I'll give a kind of a little 2-minute review of what we've gone over. It's good to see Hope and Asbury Gang over there. Welcome, you guys. Berea Gang. It's been a long day, guys. Berea Gang. There's a huge difference, right? So, glory to God. Well, a month ago, with a week break last week for Thanksgiving, we began a 5-part series on rediscovering the ancient ways of Christianity. The first 4 parts are online. And we used as our kind of book here, as our jumping off point, this book called Religion for Atheists by the noted atheist Alain de Botton. And he's a very interesting guy. Obviously, I disagree with much of what he says, but his observations and what he's kind of thinking about, I think, is very interesting to people who are believing and who are trying to figure out, how do I live a life of belief that has some real content? And what he does is he looks at Christianity and is sort of jealous. You know, what makes, this is pretty neat. I can't believe it, he says, but it's pretty awesome. And so over a period of 4 weeks, we unpack some of the things that he thinks is awesome, including the need for a community and how Christian deals with questions of loneliness, life transitions, and feasting. And the second week, we looked at how authentic religion fosters goodness and kindness in people who actually try to practice that faith authentically. Now, some of the things we looked at, the idea of religion as a kind of star chart, right? You know, you get a star for doing this, a star for doing that, and it motivates people to do the right thing based upon what that tradition says right and wrong is. Religion, Christianity in particular, gives strategies for forgetting other people, being slow to anger, putting oneself in another person's shoes, imagining how he or she might feel, setting our own struggles and our own personal drama in perspective. Religion teaches to be open to advice, even cliched advice, which is still very helpful sometimes. Christianity especially, this man argues, gives us the idea of original sin, which, you know, if we think about it, that sounds pretty bad, but what he points out is that when we recognize that everyone is fallen and everyone has flaws, it makes us more likely to be merciful toward them. Because I know, Ben, that you're not perfect. And even when you mess up, I know that you want to do the right thing, right? And you know, when I mess up, I don't want to be cruel, but I'm a broken person and I make mistakes. And that's a very important idea that underlines everything in Christianity. And this man says, wow, that's a pretty neat idea. Because what happened 200 years ago in the Enlightenment, they got this idea that mankind was a noble savage and we're all great and everything's perfect. If we can just have enough technology, enough money, and enough prosperity, Karl Marx said society would be great, right? And who is the Rousseau had the noble savage, and so forth. And Alain de Botton says, that isn't very realistic. And Jesus would say, that's not very realistic either. So in week 3, we talked about education and the problem of education as it's presently constructed in the secular world. It aspires to make us better people, but the tools it uses are pretty ineffective for a variety of reasons. And in addition to the tools being ineffective, there are no real values there that would sort of lead you to any kind of way to live your life. And so you're just kind of left there learning these random bits of information that have almost no relevance to other pieces of information that you're learning. And so it's kind of like the smorgasbord. You just pick something that sort of interests you, and so you can study, you know, the most random thing in the world. So I studied random things in college too, so that's sort of what happens sometimes. Then 2 weeks ago, in our most recent class, we spoke of how religion, according to this man, de Botton, meets some of our most basic human needs, addressing our needs for tenderness, think of the Virgin Mary, the need for sobriety, think of the idea that marriage isn't always perfectly fun all the time, the need for perspective, like my life isn't over if I get an F, right? The need for art and architecture that offers us meaning, that conveys something that elevates our soul, that speaks to the feeling most of us have that cries out for something with meaning. We all have this, I think, the desire for meaning in our lives. And so this brings us up to our final week, which is about institutions. Who needs them? And I want to start off by reading from the last chapter here. on page 278. He says this: when skeptics and atheists began their assaults on religion in the late 18th century, they did so primarily through the medium of books. They wondered in print whether a dead man could really roll back a tombstone and make his way unaided into the upper atmosphere, whether a young woman could be immaculately conceive a deity in her womb, whether battles could be won by the intercessions of angels or earaches cured by contact with the shin bone of a martyred saint, as in the stories about St. Cornelius, the centurion. And they tended to conclude their arguments by looking forward to the day when mankind might replace its superstitions, as they understood them, with rationally based ideas of the sort they admired in works of secular science and philosophy, literature and poetry. Although these skeptics proved to be caustically entertaining critics of faith, they failed to appreciate the fundamental difference between themselves and their enemies. The latter were not relying primarily on the publication of books to achieve their impact, meaning religions weren't just based on books by themselves. They were employing institutions. They were marshaling enormous agglomerations of people to act in concert upon the world through works of art, buildings, schools, uniforms, logos, rituals, monuments, and calendars. Where's the calendar? Everywhere. You know, this is what we're all about. We all have stuff everywhere. You know? So, here's what I would like to say. For me, a great contrast is when I was a little kid, my parents sent me to this non-denominational school. And they were like kind of Baptist-y, kind of Pentecostal-y. And I would go to school there, and it was totally disorganized. It was chaotic. It was extremist. It was small. And that was my life for a long time, right? And then I went to Catholic school because they had the best bang for the buck. Jacksonville, Florida, the schools were horrible and the Catholic schools were good. So you know what? My parents put me in Catholic school and they were organized, they had uniforms, they had their whole curriculum, they had their masses, they had everything, and it was done really well. I mean, I got a good education. And I met some great people in the Baptist, the little non-denominational school too, but it was a very different experience. And I came away from that, not becoming Catholic necessarily, but recognizing a lot of the good that was in that, what in my experience, and really, I think, impacted more in terms of my education and the way I looked at the world by my second experience, because it was a deep and profound experience that touched every aspect of my life. So I'll keep going here. While laying out ideas in books, which might sell anywhere from 100 copies to a few hundred thousand at very best, while this may seem a noble enough ambition, the medium of books by itself claims a meager reach compared to the wide-ranging influence which institutions can wield in the development and perpetuation of attitudes and behaviors. In his Republic, Plato, the philosopher, conveyed a touching understanding, born from experience, of the limits of the lone intellectual, when he remarked that the world would not be set right until philosophers became kings and kings became philosophers. In other words, writing books, he was acknowledging, can't be enough if one wishes to change things. Thinkers must learn to master the power of institutions for their ideas to have any chance of achieving a pervasive influence on the world. Does that make sense? I think he's absolutely right on that. You know, if you have a random dreamer, he might be really interesting, but how can that really impact people's lives? How can that really touch things? How can that really go deep into what people are doing? However, secular intellectuals have, unfortunately, long suffered from a temperamental suspicion of institutions rooted in the Romantic worldview that has colored cultural life since the 19th century. Romanticism has taught us to mock the ponderousness and strictures of institutions, their tendencies to corruption, and their tolerance of mediocrity. The ideal of the intellectual has been that of a free spirit, living beyond the confines of any system, disdainful of money, cut off from practical affairs, and privately proud of being unable to read a balance sheet. Think about it. Think of the professors we've known. Some of the best ones, the absent-minded professor model, that trope, you know, it's just kind of there. And it's respected and valued, even if we kind of recognize they can't do anything practically. If people's inner lives remain, even today, more likely to be influenced by the biblical prophets than by secular thinkers, it is due in large part to the fact that the latter have been consistently unwilling to create institutional structures through which their soul-related ideas might be disseminated successfully to a wider audience. Those with an interest in addressing the needs of the secular soul have typically lacked scale, stable conditions of employment, and the capacity to transmit their views through the mass media. Instead, volatile individual practitioners run what are in effect cottage industries, while organized religions infiltrate our consciousness with all the might and sophistication available to institutional power. This is really interesting. And what he does to sort of show this is he shows the lone writer who's critiqued, by the way, for being a hack. You heard of James Patterson before? All right. I've not read any of his books. I'm not saying he's bad or good. I read an article in the New York Times a couple months ago talking about how bad he was because he now has these understudies who write books for him. And he signs his name to them. And anyway, that's kind of what they do now if you're a big name. But he shows how many books James Patterson, how much money he brought in through his books. And here he is. He's the number one seller of books in the world. He's got a little sliver, a millimeter. Here's Procter & Gamble. And then here's the Catholic Church. His point is something to think about, right? That's all he's pointing out here. The modern world is not, of course, devoid of institutions. It is filled with institutions. What kind of institution in your mind? What institutions are both successful in bringing in money and have convictions of some sort? Can you give me any examples? At least of some sort.
Like a corporation.
Yeah. McDonald's. They believe in the customer, right? And they have lots of money. When I worked for Kohl's, when I was a seminary, I had to work for Kohl's to make ends meet. I was their customer service manager. It was fun. I could tell you some stories. And we had to rehearse their corporate ethos, which was always, yes, we can. We had to repeat this over and over. It was like corporate mind think, you know, and they had this conviction, the customer's always right. And so we did that. And that was part of our life as employees. Good evening, Ryan. The modern world has institutions. They're called commercial corporations of unparalleled size, which have an intriguing number of organizational traits in common with religions. But these corporations focus only on outer physical needs, on selling us cars and shoes, pizzas and telephones. Religion's great distinction is that while it is a collective power comparable to that of modern corporations, pushing soap or mashed potatoes, it addresses precisely those inner needs which the secular world leaves to disorganized and vulnerable individuals. So I want to move. Among the fundamental lessons of religions as institutions are the importance of scale and the benefits that flow from being able properly to aggregate money, intelligence, and status. Whereas Romanticism glorifies the achievements of singular heroes, religions know how much will be impossible if individuals act alone. Outside an organization, we may now and then succeed in securing a brief spike of fame for ourselves. We will never be able to place our achievements on a stable footing, consistently replicate our insights, or bridge our weaknesses. Soul authorship cannot be a logical long-term response to solving the complexities of significant issues. We should ask why, in matter to the soul, we continue to believe in cloistered, companionless methods of assembly that we long ago disavowed in relation to the manufacture of pharmaceuticals or aircraft. This is an important point, right? If indeed we recognize that there are some things that just work better when you have folks gathered together, why would it be different for ideas or for faith? How could that be different? And so what I want to point out here is that when people would come to Orthodoxy and say, you Orthodox, you have institutions, it's bad. I think we would say, but how else can we organize? What else is natural? How else do we help each other? How else do we share our thoughts? How else do we support the work of our church? You know, Jesus Christ, we believe, took on a body. right? He's not just a spirit. He lived in a family with all that dysfunction, right? He lived in a family. He had brothers, stepbrothers who were jealous of him, right? According to tradition, Jude and Simon were jealous of him, and only James defended him. This is his own, the sons of Joseph, according to our tradition. So, I mean, this is part of the burden of being human beings living in this world, is we have to deal with some of the challenges of family, the challenges of institutions. It's just part of the cross that we bear. So back to money here. There is a matter of income. Institutions spare the members the humiliations and terrors of the sole trader. Their ability to pool capital, distribute it between projects, and let it accumulate over decades enables institutions to survive lean periods and make adequate investments in research, marketing, recruitment, and technology. The example of that in our church, our diocese has a very ambitious program where each parish gives 10 to 15% of its income to the diocese, which is a lot for a parish our size. It's a lot of money. And we give it away to the diocese, and the diocese then invests it in new parishes. That's how this parish got started, actually. I don't know if you know this. You guys, the Searcys don't know this. This parish began as an Orthodox parish in the Orthodox Church 10, almost 11 years ago. And before it was in the OCA, it was part of a Protestant community called the Evangelical Orthodox Church. And there was about 20 people in this community that were searching to enter the canonical Orthodox Church. And so our church, the OCA, received them, brought them into our church, and they didn't have much money. But the group applied for a church planning grant and enabled enough money to be gotten from the church organization to pay for a priest to come and be here and have services and get things going. And once you had people on the ground who were doing the work of the church, it was easier for others to come. And without that, our parish wouldn't be here right now. It's the work of an institution. It isn't only, I wouldn't say that pejoratively. I just think it's like, you know, I have a job, I pay money. It's part of life. And so I think we see that in our church. Now, this summer, when we break ground, God willing, part of what will make that happen is the diocese is going to co-sign our loan. They're going to work with us to help us, and they're probably going to push us over the top to be able to make the payments, because the first couple years are going to be really, really hard. That's what you can do when you have others who are in this boat with you. De Botton sort of postulates, he says, well, let's do a contrast here between two different types of people, one who was in the institution, one who was not. He uses Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, right, the Catholic scholastic church father in the Catholic Church, and Friedrich Nietzsche, very different characters, very brilliant men who had influence for sure. Altruism, De Botton says, is probably most effective when it can be balanced and harnessed well. And the case study then is Nietzsche versus Aquinas. Aquinas lived in a benevolent and stable spiritual center. He spent his young years in a monastery that was very healthy, apparently. And then he would spend time in the university, which was also kind of like a monastery in those days. It was very, very cosmopolitan, very interesting. Lots of church services, lots of freedom to explore intellectual interests, lots of conversations happening, very good, stable environment. He had enough food, he had enough drink, you know, he lived his life in a very healthy way. Friedrich Nietzsche, as he himself said, lived like a wild animal hunted out of every lair. It's a very different kind of lifestyle. And the point that De Botton is making is that affects your productivity, that affects your mental state. Nietzsche died insane, right? And part of that choice, part of Nietzsche's lifestyle was a function of choice, right? And he chose some of the things that he did. Still, you see some of the difference that institutional support makes in helping spiritually, intellectually, aesthetically give someone support. When you look at someone like Thomas Aquinas, or frankly, you look at our saints like St. Gregory of Palamas, you know, in the Athos monasteries, Mount Athos, being nurtured by the monks, being supported by the history of the fathers there. So very important, I think. He continues, institutions have the added benefit of being able to offer permanent status to individuals simply on the basis of their membership, saving them from having to earn it purely on their own, over and over again, year by year. A lone thinker may be near the end of his life, or even like Nietzsche, long dead, before the public notices that a good idea sprung from him. Without an institution, all members can tap into a... Within an institution, all members can tap into the reputation built by illustrious forebears and reinforced by buildings and traditions. They can take on a title like priest or archdeacon or professor or minister and make use for genuinely good ends of the resources and luster stored within a structure that is larger and more endearing than themselves. That's my secret. But that's what we do in our church, right? When I share wisdom, I don't do it on the basis of me. I mean, I can share stories that might be relevant and useful to you, but you're not here because of me. You're here because our church stands for something much bigger than me or Nicholasville or even Orthodoxy in America in the 21st century. We're here because it's the living expression of God's work in humankind, right? That's what we believe about it. And that's not, because it's an institution, it's not a contradiction with the reality that we claim about it. It's also an institution. It's not merely an institution, but it has that quality. And it's not something we should be embarrassed about, I don't think. Though there are things in our history to be embarrassed about, and we can talk about that some of the time. We don't have to pretend everything in our history is perfect, not at all. But I don't think we should feel guilty that it's not perfect. You know, we shouldn't beat ourselves up over that. So, I don't know about you, but I'm not a huge fan of chain restaurants. I don't know. Do you have opinions on that? I'm not a big fan, you know. I do eat them, I'll admit, more often than this little small bohemian in me would like to admit. And why do I do this? Why would I go to Johnny Carrabba's when there's a family-owned Italian restaurant there? That might be better, maybe more local, more friendly, more authentic. You know, why do all of us at some point go to a chain restaurant? Bingo. Yeah. Any other reasons? Why would you? You're a young man. I know you like chain restaurants. I did. Do you have a favorite restaurant? Perfect. Johnny Carino's. Why do you like it? It's good. It's good? What's your favorite thing about it?
Their food?
Do you like it just for the food?
No. It's, I don't know.
It's kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
It's fun. There's a certain kind of music there. Certain style of food that you always expect. The funny thing is, when you go to a non-chain restaurant, you have no guarantee the food's actually better. You might hope it's better. You might not know the price. You might not know anything about the overall experience. Whereas at Johnny Carino's, you know kind of what it's going to cost. Your dad knows what it's going to cost. You know, the feel of it, the kind of food that's there, the kind of
whole thing. You're not likely to hear them civil around that.
Right. There's a quality threshold.
Versus a chain restaurant.
Yeah.
Or local restaurant I'm frequently going to. They frequently tell me, no, we don't have that today. And I'm like, that's what I came here for.
Right. Right. So it could be local, but in that kind of backwoods way, when you go to one of these local restaurants. And that isn't always good. It could be incredibly bad. You just don't know. But the key words, I think, consistency, right? You know, one of the familiar things is consistency. I'm going to read this from De Botton. Another useful feature of institutions is their ability to coalesce the efforts of their members to a shared visual vocabulary. Here again, the strategies of religions and commercial corporations can overlap. While the sight of a cross emblazoned on the side of an ecclesiastical building or a lamb embroidered on an altar cloth, it's frequently prompted the observation that Christianity was an early and adept practitioner of the same kind of branding that our modern corporations specialize in. The truth is, of course, the reverse. It is the corporations that have faithfully adopted the lessons of an identity pioneered, at some level, by religion. The most important function of a brand is to promote consistency. Institutions trust that the appearance of their logo, whether on a remote mountainside, or on the top of a skyscraper, on a bedsheet, on a cloak, will instantly communicate the reliable presence of a particular set of values and act as a promise of uniformity and quality. When Walmart changed their logo was a big deal. Remember that? It, Jaina went from that kind of harsh logo to the softer one. Logos convey a lot of things. The enemy of branding is local variation. Here, too, we sense a certain tension between romantic and institutional values. For whereas romanticism appreciates the charm of the particular and the regional, I do myself, the homemade and the spontaneous, institutions cannot forget the hazards of provincial initiatives. Instead of touching improvements on the rules of the center, they see deviations from minimal standards. You know, the bad food, the bad possibilities, and not just the good ones. They're reminded of corruption and laziness and degeneracy and the abandonment of initial ambitions. To stamp out eccentricities, for instance, the training manual for the new staff at McDonald's runs to 300 pages, providing instructions for every imaginable action and transaction. There are rules about where the employee's name badge must be placed, what sort of smile each customer should be treated to, and precisely how much mayonnaise should be added to the underside of every bun. The hamburger company has little faith in what the members of its workforce will do if left their own devices. In this, at least, McDonald's has much in common with the Catholic Church, which has similarly spent a good deal of its history struggling to ensure a regularity of service across the vast and scattered labor force. Taking collectively its edicts, specifically specifying details down to what sort of wine should be used at Holy Communion, and what color priest's shoes even might be, indicate extreme concern about the standards of its peripheral branches. You know, now the Catholic Church is well over the top compared to us. I mean, there's the old saying, I don't believe in organized religion, I'm Orthodox. You know, compared to Rome, we're not very organized, and we're a little scattered. But, I mean, I'll give you an example here. This is, before I give you this example, I'll share some things. So much in our history, though, in Christian history, you know, early church even, has to do with bringing people together and having some kind of shared common experience that is the basis for being together, that helps us relate to each other no matter where we are in the world. So, for instance, what was one of the earliest controversies in the beginning in the late first century and then exploding in the second century? What was an early Christian controversy? And both parties were totally Orthodox, and totally, they weren't heretics. Think calendar.
Date of Easter.
The date of Easter. Mm-hmm. When to celebrate Easter. There were two legitimate traditions that were apostolic, right? One was from John. John the Apostle's tradition was to celebrate Easter on the 14th of Nisan, which was the actual date that Christ's resurrection took place on the Jewish calendar. So maybe it would fall on Monday. Easter could fall on Monday or on Sunday or on Wednesday, depending on the year. It's like Christmas. It rotates through all the different days. Well, in Rome and in most of the other parts of the Christian world, they had the practice that we now have of celebrating Easter on a Sunday. Right? It would float depending on where the moon cycle was. And it got so intense. I mean, they all agreed. But the bishop in Rome said, no, we should all do it my way. And the bishops in Ephesus, who were spiritual grandchildren of St. John the Apostle, said, no, St. John taught us this. We're not changing. And they agreed to disagree for a while. But eventually, by the 4th century, there's another, as the Christian world's coming together even more, there is a push to have one time that Easter celebrated. Why? Is it just for uniformity's sake? No. But it's so that when I visit Ephesus, I can celebrate with them. And I know what's going on. When they visit Alexandria, we have a shared vocabulary, a shared experience, a shared vision of what the church is like. And
just had some share about yeah. that. Just that I think I remember being in Alaska one time. I was like way out in the middle of nowhere on St. Paul Island in the Bering Sea, halfway between Russia and Alaska. And I walked into an island, and there was a little church there, you know, because to me, like, this is like when you compare corporations and chain restaurants versus local restaurants, I think it's nice when it's a combination of both, which I think, like,
Orthodoxy
like, when I walked in there, like, it's the native traditions,
it smelled like an Orthodox church, didn't it?
Yeah, like, it was the same thing. And as soon as I walked in, I'm just this white guy who's like crab fishing in the port, but as soon as I walk in there and I cross myself, all of a sudden, it doesn't even matter if we speak the same language or if they're doing something totally different. It's just, I feel like there are little things that are like the basic connections, you know, like, and I was just welcomed, you know, and I was immediately part of that community, you know, like, and to me, like, that's the thing, it is what it is, you know, like, and I feel like the Catholic Church, for instance, not to criticize them, but like the Latin Mass, for instance, all over the world.
It's too much of a good thing.
I think that's more along the lines, I think, of the more corporate, or whatever you would call that structure, but I like that there's a lot of diversity.
You're anticipating where I want to go, which was, I think in Orthodoxy, we've struck a balance there. And we need to recognize that the healthy institution is going to have to strike a balance between local variation, but also having a sense of identity that allows us to come together.
Community globally.
Yeah. Well, that's great. But there are guidelines that are around the whole world about what kind of bread we use in the community. You know, how it should be baked. What kind of wines are we? I can't use white wines. I can't use wines that are fortified. I can't use, it has to be grape wine. You know, grape wine. What kind of architecture is conceivable for proper temples? What kind of liturgy we serve? You know, I have to serve from the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. I have to serve a kind of certain way so that, honestly, I've never been in a place where Greek or Romanian, Russian, American, I've never been in an Orthodox church where I could not serve the liturgy because we all have a common vocabulary. Even we literally don't have the same language. I can serve with someone with whose language I don't understand because the liturgy looks similar enough in each situation. If I have my service in English, I can follow along and I can say a litany in my tongue. And we had Father Andre, was a Russian friend of mine, came to visit four or five years ago here. Doesn't speak a word of English. Didn't matter. He pulled his service book out. He served the liturgy in Russian, in Slavonic. And people were just tickled because they knew he couldn't do English. He tried to do a little bit in English. It was really bad. But it was sweet and everyone appreciated it. But that's the beauty of having that measure of unity. I thought I'd share this with you because it shows one of the areas that the church, I think, tries to bring a measure of I think what the church does a good job of bringing a measure of this is our culture as a church, and yet also letting people be people is in the way she treats her priests. You know, Ben, you've met a lot of priests. There's a lot of commonalities in the priesthood, aren't there? The way we dress, perhaps. But some priests will wear, some priests will wear this more. Some won't wear those. I mean, so there's a lot of variation and there's a lot of commonalities. Most priests tend to wear black shoes, maybe not all the time. Most priests tend to have a certain way of dealing with people that we learn through other priests that have taught us. And then certain things like what I'm going to read with you impact how priests approach the priesthood. This is something that every priest has to sign before he's ordained. So I'll just share it with you. It's kind of interesting. I found this recently. I am of the Orthodox Christian faith. As such, I am not in communion with the heterodox. Number one. I am not a Mason or my member of any subversive secret organization. I've never been convicted of any felony or misdemeanor. You know, there are no legal impediments to my being ordained. I'm in good physical condition, which can mean a lot of different things. I do not possess any incurable diseases or physical defects, which would be an impediment to ordination. I'm requesting ordination for no reason other than to serve God and the church according to the holy canons and traditions established by the holy fathers. Hence, I further promise to A, celebrate all rites and services according to the order of the Orthodox Church and be satisfied with the freewill offerings of my parishioners, meaning I won't go begging you for cash, unless it's a building project. To celebrate on Sunday and holy days, that's not for me though, celebrate on holy days and Sundays the divine liturgy and other services, to observe the fasts. B, to preach the word of God to those entrusted to my care, and to all who would hear it, and to take all measures to teach God's people, regardless of age, by teaching classes, retreats, and other educational ministries. C, to keep a decorous home, as behooves one serving the holy altar. That's a scary one. What does decorous mean? Does it mean like clean? D, to conduct myself properly in the sanctuary, that's the altar, and to serve as an example to others, to be concerned with the beauty of the Lord's house, E, did nothing to bring discredit to my office. F, to dress in accordance with my calling. And priests interpret that different ways, of course. G, to do nothing without the will of my bishop, to adhere always to instructions from the diocesan authority and the church administration. H, to be guided by the teaching of the Holy Orthodox Catholic faith and the Holy Fathers. And A, to have my certificate of ordination available at all times. So this is what the priest had to sign. And then he gives an oath of allegiance. I, the undersigned, presently called to the order of the Holy Priesthood, bow down to Almighty God as witness in the Holy Gospels and make the solemn vow. I promise, in accordance with the will of God, to fulfill all the Orthodox Church observances, services, rituals, prayers as prescribed by the Holy Tradition. That's a lot. I'll recite the prescribed prayers diligently before offering the Holy Eucharist. I will vow not to introduce any changes or innovations to the customary church worship services. I promise to uphold the teachings of the truth and other pastoral instructions according to the teaching of the Holy Orthodox Catholic Church and the Fathers, to endeavor with my mind, heart, and soul to protect the souls of the faithful people entrusted to me against every heresy and schism, to labor with every means available to return to the true flock of Christ any who have strayed away from this path. I vow to lead an honorable and sober life, putting aside all that is vain, worldly, and vulgar, to set a good example in humility and meekness, to order in order to guide others to good and noble things. In all that I do, I will seek not my own vain honor and interest, but the glory of God, the welfare of his church, and the salvation of my neighbor. I am assured in my heart that by the prayers of the all-pure Theotokos and all the saints, the Lord God will help me with his blessings and mercies. In affirmation of this vow, I kiss the word and cross of my Savior, Jesus Christ. You know, when you have your priest signing things like this, this is kind of what's giving shape to the way we approach things. If they take it seriously, and they should, that's going to impact your church and create a situation where if you meet Father so-and-so in Alaska and Father Jimmy down in Arkansas, they're going to have something in common, you know, in addition to their formation. And, of course, having bishops work together, even if you have a bishop in Alaska and one in Florida, they sit on the same synod, they have to deal with each other, so there's a common culture there. And there's variation, and there's also commonality. And I think that's a really healthy and beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think it's nice to have, like, so many, at least for me growing up, and it's like so many homes, you know, like, yeah. I can walk into a church in the middle of nowhere, and
yeah.
I have a spiritual father, and I have, like, you know, like, I can go to...
You have auxiliary spiritual fathers, too.
Yeah, you know, like, or just a community. But at the same time, it's like the best of both worlds, I think. You know, like, having a world community and
every parish is
a local community. Yeah.
Thanks, man. It's good to have that perspective. Dave Bouton writes this. It is a singularly regrettable feature of the modern world that while some of the most trivial of our requirements, for example, shampoo and moisturizers, are met by superlatively managed brands, our essential needs are left to the unpredictable care of lone actors. For a telling illustration of the practical effects of branding and the quality control it typically brings, we need only compare the fragmented, highly variable field of psychotherapy with the elegantly discharged ritual of confession within the Catholic faith. Confession, for Catholics, well-regimented in its every particular since the latter part of the 14th century, thanks to a stream of papal edicts, is an epitome of the sort of reliable global service industry that will become the norm for consumer goods only in the mid-20th century. Everything from the positioning of the confessional box to the tone of the voice used by the priest is governed by explicit rules designed to assure all Catholics from Melbourne to Anchorage that their expectations for redemptive examination of their soul will be met. No such provisions apply to our closest secular equivalent. Psychotherapy, as currently practiced, lacks any consistency of setting or even any benchmarks for such apparently small yet critical details as the wording of the message on the therapist's answering machine, his or her dress code, and the appearance of the consulting room. Patients are left to endure a run of local quirks, from encounters with a therapist's pets or children to gurgling pipework and bric-a-brac furnishings. I love the way he writes. It's funny. Do you agree? I'm curious. Like, is that something, some people might say, well, I like that variation. I think it's really neat. Others might say, no, that reinforces my fears about this therapist being kind of out there. I don't know. I don't know what I think about that myself. But any thoughts? I take it for what it is. I mean, I don't agree or disagree. I just find it entertaining and something that is worth thinking about. He laments that corporations, while so good at doing a multitude of things on a low level, you know, giving sunglasses and, you know, new trinkets, they can't rise to do some of the good things that are oftentimes needed, like organizing quality education, providing things that might help people cope with their day-by-day struggles, etc. He writes this: "It is perhaps a failing of historic proportions that BMW's concern for rigor and precision has ended so conclusively at the bumpers of its cars, rather than stretching the founding of a school, or that Giorgio Armani's eponymous corporation has determinedly skirted the possibility of running a therapy unit or a liberal arts college." Which is kind of funny. "Intellectual movements have likewise, and just as regrettably, shunned attempts at brand extension. They failed to imagine that their ideas could generate complementary, analogous services and products in the material realm and become more vivid to us for having physical equivalents. What makes religion so distinctive is that they have dared to assert coherent brand identities across a diverse range of areas, from the strictly intellectual and theological to the aesthetic, sartorial, and culinary. Christianity, Judaism, and Buddhism have all succeeded in relating larger ideas about the salvation of mankind to such subordinate material activities as managing weekend retreats, radio stations, restaurants, museums, lecture halls, and even clothing. Because we are embodied creatures," and this is very orthodox here, this one passage, "because we are embodied creatures, sensory animals as well as rational beings, we stand to be lastingly influenced by concepts only when they come to us through a variety of channels." Isn't that true? We're only impacted when we see it a dozen different ways. "As religions seem alone and properly understanding, we cannot be adequately marked by ideas unless, in addition to being delivered through books, lectures, and newspapers, they are also echoed in what we wear, eat, sing, decorate our houses with, and bathe in." And this is why I like this book, because he points this truth out that I think our world is blind to it, at least intellectually. We get it by the way we buy things from the store. We get it with marketing. We don't get it though with our souls. And so sometimes, one of my best friends is, he'll read philosophy all day long, and that's all he can do. There's nothing else he can do. You know, it's a text. It's just something he interacts with textually. And you can do Christianity that way too. And that's one of the great tragedies of our time. You can do the Bible and me by ourselves, and just that's Christ, you know. But for the Orthodox, there's so many layers of experience in Christ. There's the text, of course. There's music. And there's seeing his icon. And there's smelling the incense, remembering the community. There is tasting him in the Holy Communion. There is kissing him as I greet Nate and Ryan Paul, and as we greet the neighbors, and seeing all these things as enfleshed experiences of the will of God, you know, the presence of God in our midst. You know, there's touching as I fall on the ground and do prostration and say, "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner." And all these things that come to touch back in again on the mystery of who God is. And it's not just a text. It's not just an idea. It's something that is taken on flesh and is very real. And that's something that we can't, we are foolish not to pause and re-reflect on that over and over and over and over again. So some closing thoughts and institutions here, where I'm in the last couple pages. "Religions bring scale. They bring consistency in outer-directed force to what might otherwise remain small, random, private moments. They give substance to our inner dimensions, precisely those parts of us which romanticism prefers to leave unregulated, for fear of hampering our chances of authenticity. They don't solely relegate our feelings to volumes of poetry or essays, texts, knowing that books are in the end hushed objects in a noisy world. When it is springtime, Judaism, for instance, takes hold of us with a force that Wordsworth or Keats never employed. At the first blossoming of trees, The faithful are told to gather outdoors with the rabbi and together recite the Birkat Ilanot, a ritual prayer from the Talmud honoring the hand that made the blossom. And the quote is, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who did not leave a single thing lacking in his world, filling it with the finest creatures and trees so as to give pleasure to all mankind." How does Orthodoxy take these moments that are perhaps theologically very rich, but how does it express these theologically rich things externally? What are some examples in the calendar of the church here?
Blessing of the waters.
Blessing of the waters. Yeah. Here we are. We throw the cross into the water. In Tarpon Springs, Florida, the patriarch of the patriarch comes every couple years and he throws this massive cross into the water. Blessed art thou, Lord, and glorious are the works. And there is no word but suffice it to him that I wonder. And he throws the thing into the water. And it turns into a whole festival, right? All the kids jump in and they get the cross out. I mean, it's a theological statement. For us, it's a sacramental reality. It's also a heck of a lot of fun, you know? And it's culture. And it's all these things coming together in one. And it's beautiful. And it's impressionable. And it's more powerful than reading a bunch of books. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's kind of what's going on there. Theophany was another example.
Pascha.
What is a greater impression of the light conquering the darkness than seeing the light snuffed out, total darkness, and then from the tomb, from the altar, comes one flame, or three actually, because I have a little triple candlestick, comes one flame and then three flames out. And then the priest says, "Come receive the light." And the light is passed from person to person, and the light goes out into the world. What? That's powerful. Nativity. Even the picking of when we celebrate Christmas, it's the darkest day of the year. At least it was at one point. It's close to the winter solstice, right? It's the day when the light shines the least. The Father's did it on purpose because the light will then grow brighter and brighter and brighter in the summer. So when does Christ become in the darkest, the darkness, and the darkness he comes and brings light?
Forgiveness of Vespers.
Forgiveness, right. How else to begin Lent than with asking forgiveness of our brethren? And how else to do it than to do it with our hands and with our mouths and with our bodies? Doesn't your back hurt after forgiveness of Vespers?
Everything hurt after forgiveness
of Vespers. You guys, forgiveness of Vespers is how we begin Great Lent. It's an incredible, I hope you guys, it's an amazing service. One of the most, I don't know. It changed my life, actually, for some reason. So, anyway, but all these things are part of our church life and part of who we are. So, my closing paragraph here tonight, again, from him. We need institutions to foster and protect those emotions to which we sincerely are inclined, but which without a supporting structure and a system of active reminders will be too distracted and undisciplined to make time for. The secular romantic world sees in commodification only loss of diversity, of quality, and spontaneity. But at its finest, the process enables fragile, rare, but important aspects of existence to be more easily identified and more dependably shared. Now he's speaking as an atheist. This is where I take issue with it. Those of us who hold no religious belief still require regular, ritualized encounters with concepts such as friendship, community, gratitude, and transcendence. We cannot rely on being able to make our own way to them on our own. We need institutions that can remind us that we need them and present them to appealing wrappings, thus ensuring the nourishment of the most forgetful and unself-aware sides of our soul. He's speaking to the weakness of human beings here. You know, we're kind of weak. We're kind of fragmented. And without a nudge in the right direction, will I do the right thing? You know, without having a prayer rule, will I really get up and pray to God every day? I mean, honestly, some people will, but I probably won't. Because I'm not the kind of, you know, there are the exceptional people that just burn their whole life with love for God. But I need a kick in the pants. You know, and Orthodoxy does that for us. You know? What I also read about our faith too is our faith doesn't put God in a box, so that there are people that I know doesn't apply to them the way it applies to me and 98% of the rest of us. But that's okay. Our tradition deals with that too. I mean, we have categories of people that are not like everyone else. You know, St. Seraphim of Sarov was not like everybody else. He didn't do the prayer that I do. He went way beyond it, you know, and he delighted in it. And he gives us something to shoot for, you know, without us hating ourselves either, because we can look at him and be discouraged. But our tradition even offers a way to process St. Seraphim of Sarov without it overwhelming us and causing us to engage in self-hate. So this is the last paragraph now, sorry. This is sort of a summary of some of the things that are important. Fortunately for the concepts examined here, none are new. They've existed for most of human history, only to be overhastily sacrificed a few hundred years ago on the altar of reason, and unfairly forgotten by secular minds repelled by religious belief. It has been the purpose of this book to identify some of the lessons we might retrieve from religions, how to generate feelings of community, how to evoke kindness among us, how to cancel out the current bias towards commercial values and advertising, how to select and make use of secular heroes, how to rethink the strategies of universities in our approach to education, how to redesign hotels and spas, how to better acknowledge our own childlike needs, how to surrender some of our counterproductive optimism, how to achieve perspective in the sublime and the transcendent, how to reorganize museums, how to use architecture to enshrine values, and finally, how to coalesce the scattered efforts of individuals interested in the care of souls and organize them under the aegis of institutions. You know, I read this and I like this man so much. I like what he's saying. But at the end, I'm grateful that as a believer, I don't have to try to reinvent the institutions that he's speaking of or try to reinvent a theology. I have it. If I can believe it, one, and if I can believe it, and then two, if I can be faithful to live it. But I would say, you know, I almost want to ask you to hit pause. Professor Meyendorf at St. Vlad's, whenever he has something scandalous to say, he's already going, turn your tape recorder off. And we don't turn our recorders off. I'm recording it myself. You know, I've had a couple friends in Orthodoxy who have struggled to believe. And as they began to try to live an Orthodox life, they find themselves beginning to be able to believe. You know, and I think sometimes we're on a quest for authenticity. We want to be so authentic with everything we do that we kind of live unable to commit to something. So I guess the challenge that I have to give to myself is, okay, I don't feel good about every little thing in our Orthodox faith. Do I understand every aspect of our tradition? Do I fully internalize every aspect of our tradition? I try to. But do I do that? I don't think so. But I think as I try to live it as best I can, I find God there. God is not the tradition. Tradition is not God. But I find God within that context. I meet him there. And that's something that I think is good to be reminded of. And if we can bear that, we can think about that. Because we have all these riches, the very things he's wishing he had. We have them all in Orthodox Christianity. But our challenge is to live them, and as we live them, maybe perhaps come to really, truly believe them. But believe something to go into. It doesn't happen overnight for 90% of us. St. Paul, I had a professor at seminary who said it's really unfortunate that St. Paul's, the model of St. Paul's conversion, you know, the Damascus Road became kind of normative. That's not normative. That's what normal people encounter God. Most of us grow into faith over time. You know, I certainly did. I didn't wake up one day and said, I want to go off and become a priest. That didn't happen. But faith is nurtured and faith can grow. And that's a true joy for me to see that in the lives of people in parish and in my own life too. So God bless you all. Are there any